You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Carolyn Vanderweel.
And I'm Ron Bronson. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, September 28th, 2017.
Wow. One time we almost shot down A707, taking some people back.
Oh, no kidding.
Back off.
Misidentified?
No, they just screwed up. And, but luckily they had a kill switch for that missile.
Big Talk's Michael Glab speaks with John Tilford, a veterans' rights activist and former military advisor over Afghanistan. That's coming up today's show, episode of Big Talk.
Also coming up in the next half hour, our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks your friends and neighbors how they feel about the NFL protests. But first, these local headlines.
The Cook Group will pay $100,000 a year to the city of Bloomington, according to an agreement announced earlier this afternoon. Bloomington and the Cook Group have agreed to enter what's been called an agreement in lieu of annexation, pending final approval of the agreement by the city council on October 18th. The agreement would obligate Cook to pay, in lieu of taxes, a total of $1.5 million over the next 15 years in exchange for the city to agree not to annex Cook properties currently outside the city limits. According to a statement from the city's press office, the payment, if approved by the city council, would increase if Cook fails to meet certain prescribed goals for financial investment and increased employment in Monroe County. The payments will be placed in the city's general fund. A statement issued by the Bloomington Communications Director, Mary Catherine Carmichael, said the city entered into agreements in lieu of annexation in the past, in 1979, but it expired in 2012. The Cook Group announced the sale of its pharmaceutical division, Cook Pharmaco, last Tuesday for almost $1 billion. On the same day, the Cook Group announced that it closed a deal to buy the vacant GE manufacturing facility on Bloomington's west side for $6.5 million. Cook expected to move into the former GE appliances plant on Curry Pike at the end of 2017, and that expansion would translate into 500 additional jobs in Bloomington over the next decade. The city stated in a press release, quote, "This move represents a planned local investment of more than $100 million, and the proposed agreement in lieu of annexation is a significant factor in Cook's willingness to continue to invest in Bloomington's community," end quote. Cook Group President Pete Yonkman mentioned a pending deal with the City of Bloomington last Friday during the Monroe County Economic Development Committee meeting. Bloomington dropped annexation efforts after an amendment to the State of Indiana's budget bill placed a moratorium on annexation efforts by the city for the next 5 years. As of press time, it was unclear whether the city had dropped a lawsuit against Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb over the amendment. The proposed agreement in lieu of annexation will go before the City Council at their next meeting on October 4th.
Indianapolis-based developer Mecca Companies Incorporated is receiving multiple incentives to increase affordable housing in Bloomington. The Bloomington City Council approved giving Mecca a 10-year tax break worth more than $1 million as incentive for a proposed affordable housing complex at 1100 North Crescent Drive. In the council's September 28th meeting, Council Chair Susan Sandberg said the proposed development project is a worthy investment.
We don't always want to give tax abatements away readily or easily unless there's a real clear public benefit to this, and I think we've all seen that loud and clear. This is exactly the kind of development that we all want to see, and we're all willing to make public investments in order to see more affordable housing come online. So that's why we've all pretty much agreed that this is a good use of our housing development fund and all the other resources that are going to come to bear to make this project happen.
Director of Economic Development Alex Crowley says over half of the project's units will accommodate people making below the area's median income, or AMI.
So just to highlight a couple of the elements of it, it's about a $17.5 million investment, 146 total units, of which 70% will be affordable, and that's defined as being 60% or less of the AMI.
Bloomington's area median income is estimated at approximately $49,900. 60% or less of the area median income translates to an annual income of approximately $26,000 for a single person. Crowley says rent for the remaining apartments will be set at market rate. He said the ratio of affordable housing units will change over time.
So 20% of the units will be guaranteed market rate, with the last 10% determined by market forces. The affordability period, which is 99 years in total, will be split as follows. The first 30 years will be 70% affordable units of the total complex. And then for years 31 through 99, it will be 50% of the units. So a slight decrease, which is actually good because that increases the balance between market rate and affordability in this development, which is one of its strengths.
Crowley says the city is giving developers an additional incentive with a $500,000 investment from the city's newly created Housing Development Fund. That investment will be split into a $250,000 grant and a $250,000 loan. Councilmember Isabel Piedmont-Smith asked Crowley about the terms of Housing Development Fund loans.
The loan itself will be a loan of 0.5%, so a very low interest loan. It will be an amortization of 35 years, but the term of the loan will be 15 years. So effectively, it'll be a balloon at the end of 15 years. So we expect to be fully repaid on that loan by year 15.
Developers are also looking to receive $300,000 in federal block grant monies through the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Monroe County officials and social service agencies came together today for Monroe County's first annual opioid summit. The day-long event was held at the Monroe County Convention Center. Panel discussions convened on a range of topics, including child welfare, community policing, needle exchanges, and reducing stigma of addiction. A few survivors recounted their personal experiences with addiction. A consistent theme arose in many panels, the need for more compassion and support within the community. In a panel discussion of effectiveness treatments for opioid addictions, Bloomington psychiatrist Dr. Nishani Gundawarde said drugs are only 30% of the solution.
Medication is 30%. What's the other 70%? You know what I would love to see? I would love to see living wage, $15 an hour for my patients with felony charges at some of these big cook, IU, wealthy, capitalist, you know, groups. Start hiring my felony patients. Give them subsidized housing, $100 a month for the first 6 months that you're clean and sober participating with. I mean, this is my ideal. $15 an hour, full insurance, you know, housing.
Dr. Gundawarde walks with drug addicts through Centerstone, an addiction recovery service that provides so-called wraparound services, mental health care, employment coaching, plus help with jail or court issues. She says it's no surprise that many recovering addicts relapse on other substances like methamphetamines. She told a room of 50 attendees the story of a client who needed the stability of a work release program, which Monroe County does not have. Instead, he ended up back on the street.
Why do they relapse on meth? Because they're at McDonald's, $7 and a quarter to pay back that fine, you know, for all their child support, their probation fines. You know, they have no energy. They're in early recovery. It sucks. Someone offers you meth. Why not?
In a subsequent panel discussion on the community's response to the opioid crisis, City Council Member Dorothy Granger expressed frustration with residents who have the attitude, "Not in my neighborhood." She recounted comments city residents have made to her.
It's the not my neighborhood. Oh, okay, and we've got an issue with people who might be homeless or living in poverty. Well, let's just move them out to the fairgrounds. We might have an issue with people misusing opioids. Well, let's just move them out to the fairgrounds. Well, no, I'm serious. There are people who just think we should round people up and put them someplace else. They don't want to see it. Nobody wants to see it, but for a variety of reasons.
Granger says many times people are uncomfortable seeing a person who is homeless, high, or mentally ill on the street because they feel powerless to help. But panelists agreed the community has a responsibility to help those who live in and are part of the community. The toll on community resources was a consistent concern during the summit. Health Department Administrator Penny Caudill said the city and the county will have to find a way to fund the needed services, like needle exchanges. Caudill said community partnerships are essential for extending local resources. For WFHB, I'm Ron Bronson.
And I'm Carolyn Vandeweel. Support for WFHB and the Daily Local News comes from Smithville Fiber, a local provider of internet, voice, and TV service, now also offering home automation and security systems for homes and offices throughout South Central Indiana. More information on Smithville's home automation service is available at smithvillesecurity.com.
Veterans Issues Advocate John Tilford served in the Marines and Vietnam, and later, a few years later, joined the Army Reserve. He eventually became a key intelligence figure on Afghanistan just before the United States went to war there in 2001. Tilford's intelligence work has included analyzing the actions of the North Korean leadership, as well as the relationship between India and Pakistan. He talks about his service and his life as he joins Michael Glab on this week's edition of Big Talk.
Hi, this is Big Talk. Michael Glab here, my guest in the studio this week, John Tilford, one of the premier voices of our area for Veterans Affairs.
I'm not sure I want to say it quite that way. Of course, one of the benefits of getting old is you've been around for a while. And, well, I started doing Veterans Affairs in 1975. For the federal VA, and found it really interesting and rewarding.
And one of the reasons you're involved with this is that you are a veteran times two. You started off as just a punk kid, 1965, joining the Marine Corps. You quit college.
Well, quit sounds like I had control of it at that point. I think it was the other way around. I was 17 and started that fall of 64, and really enjoyed playing basketball late hours in the hyper, and had all morning classes and didn't get out of bed until about 10 or 11 o'clock.
Huh.
And thought I could fake my way through IU the same way I'd fake my way through high school.
Yeah.
And I found out too late that semester that that really wasn't going to happen. Felt really bad because Dad had saved money for, you know, years, savings bonds for his only son to go to college. And how can I escape this situation? I know. I couldn't speak French, so I couldn't go to the Foreign Legion. So I went to the Marine Corps.
This is at the time that Vietnam is just heating up. You knew that there was trouble brewing.
But I didn't care. You know, at that point in my life, my mom had passed away, didn't have any serious girlfriend. I thought, what the heck? I also thought, hey, I'll get out and I'll have the GI Bill at that time and I'll go back to school then. And things worked out.
So Vietnam is heating up. Did you go?
Sure. Not as quickly as my platoon mates, so to speak. I remember the one evening, the senior drill came out. This is after the graduation ceremonies. We're still in the same old barracks we've been in for quite a while. And he's reading off the orders.
Yeah.
And you can imagine the laughter at some point. Like the platoon guy that was always out of step and dropping things, ordnance disposal. That was a big laugh for everybody.
What was your job in Vietnam?
I was a computer maintenance repair man. Had I been a sergeant instead of a corporal, I would have been a technician. The title changed at grade level.
Yeah.
But you have to understand, computers at that time had very, very few integrated circuits.
Yeah.
You had big 5/8-inch cards where you could actually see transistors, capacitors, and those kind of things. And you could troubleshoot with a millimeter and find what's wrong, pull it out, put a new one in, and let it go.
So whereabouts in country were you?
People say you can't go any further east than Da Nang without being in the water, but really there's a nice little peninsula that sticks out from Da Nang to this day. It's a recreational area right now.
Huh.
And the nickname is Monkey Mountain. Also shared the mountaintop with a Hawk missile battery, which accidentally fired a couple of missiles.
Wow.
One time we almost shot down a 707, taking some people back
home. No kidding.
Back home.
Misidentified?
No, they just screwed up.
Yeah,
but luckily they had a kill switch for that missile.
So you left the Marines in 1969, then you went back to Indiana University, a little different kind of a guy.
You're thinking right. And, I was looking forward to it anyway. It was the same classes, same me, same brain, in some cases same instructors, and it was a 4-point. Of course, I dropped German to get the 4-point because I realized I had to work at that, but... No, he's much more mature, obviously, at that time.
So you're in the private world for a few years, but golly, 1976, you joined the National Guard?
Oh, yes. And by that time, I had the two kids.
Uh-huh.
Polly's had this. Our second child, Sarah, was born in 76. I thought, hey, I could use some more income.
Polly is your wife.
Exactly right. P-O-L-L-Y, like Polly Wanacracker, or Polly's maiden name, Bruce Scottish, and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And tried the Indiana National Guard in the Martinsville unit, and didn't like it at all. Went down to Fort Benning with 300 Officer Basic School. Years after that, through the advanced schools, and we're talking several months for the basic, and it was pretty stressful, but I kind of in a weird way enjoyed it. Then, as you can only be reserves or active in an officer slot, like a limited period of time, typically 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I ran out of spots as a first lieutenant and a captain, and to get to be a major, I had to look for someplace else. And right there in the same reserve building at the College Mall were two intelligence attachments, and they had major spots, no pun intended. And I applied, and Jim Curry, who lives over in Owen County near Spencer, was the active commander, signed for me to come in as an operations officer for him. Went to Fort, we call it Fort Coochie Coochie, it was called Wayachuca in Arizona, and did a couple of 2 week annual trainings out there to transition from infantry to, well, actually added additional skills for intelligence. And really, you know, I'll fast forward to 98 as doing an occupational analysis for military intelligence, especially it is a kind of an HR program for DIA. And it turns out that the skill set for a military intelligence analyst is remarkably similar to a journalist.
Huh.
You get sources, you determine what sources are accurate, those you can trust, you rate them, you take a material, you project that in the future, you draw conclusions, you present those conclusions, and it worked out. In other words, if you can read and write and think and present, summarize, make a case, it'll almost overlap into paralegal. You too, Big Mike, can be an intelligence analyst, no problem. Journalists kind of just switch over pretty easily. If they're good journalists, they go through these hack people, you know, kind of stuff you see on the telly. Forget that. But it's an interesting experience, and it's the most productive I think I ever felt in my life.
What do we owe veterans?
The freedoms we have. To be real blunt, there's a lot of places. Well, look at Western Europe too, as far as the United Kingdom and of course Canada and ourselves. So many of us are. We take. Here, you and I can have a radio recording, and this goes out over the air, and it's not being censored by Big Brother, Big Sister, or whatever. This is just unbelievable. It's just people don't realize how, I would say lucky, but it's not luck, how privileged we are
mm-hmm.
to live where we live and to have these freedoms we have. I guess my point being, in this world, we have Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and you pick all the villains you want to pick, and they're all North Korea, of course. There are a lot of people we would consider crazy opportunists or whatever. And if there's a vacuum, they will fill it the way they want to fill it.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we don't want to use the military, you better have one. And it better be very, very effective.
John Tilford has served the United States of America, continues to serve it. Thanks for joining us on Big Talk.
Well, certainly. Thank you, Mike. Anytime. How much money are you going to pay me now?
Let me dig in my pocket
here.
That's yeah.
Good.
That was Michael Glab speaking with John Tilford about his military experience as an intelligence figure on Afghanistan. This and other episodes of Big Talk are available on our website at wfhb.org.
Support for WFHB comes from Monster Digital Marketing, offering digital marketing solutions for small businesses. Monster Digital Marketing websites are built for search engine optimization with both the desktop and the mobile device user in mind. Located at monsterdigitalmarketing.com or on the phone at 317-567-1197.
Support also comes from MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
And up next, our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents.
This week on Voices in the Street, taking a knee during the national anthem. Is it an appropriate form of protest? Since Colin Kaepernick began kneeling during the national anthem in the 2016 preseason, the gesture has become a common sight prior to NFL games. Last weekend, President Trump weighed in, suggesting that NFL owners should fire NFL players who protest by taking a knee. We have gone out into the streets and asked, how do you feel about football players taking a knee during the national anthem?
I mean, personally, I'm all for it. It's all about that free speech thing that, you know, America's all about. So if that's their way to get their word out about the police brutality or whatever their cause is, I mean, there's no, as I'll say, there's no proper way to protest. There's no, like, positive, or not positive, but no right way to protest. And the way they're doing it is as peaceful and as, I guess, clean as you could possibly do it. So I'm all for it.
I believe that some of it is necessary. It's just trying to people are trying to take a stand and show what they believe in. And I think it's accurate.
I think it's cool that, like, they have the, like, religious freedom to be able to do that. To be able to, I guess, like, express their beliefs in a way that is respectful, but also it's not, like, in your face, you know, to people who might not be open to, like, anything about God, but they're still able to express that viewpoint and be able to, like, honor and express, like, their own beliefs in a way that is, like, respectful, but also still, like, dignified, and, like, they're able to do it.
I just think it's, like, it's cool that that they do that. I think it makes them more dignified in a way, and respectful. Kind of brings peace to them, and it's able to help them to give respect to other people as, like, their peers or just anybody in the community.
I don't know. I kind of think that people should be able to kneel when they want and, you know, portray their how they feel about the way society is going. I think it's definitely unfortunate because it really stirs up a lot of emotions in people's hearts. And, you know, when that kind of stuff happens, you know, people kind of lose morale. And I think people should focus on the good things that are going on.
It was incredibly disappointing to me that so many people chose to kneel for the anthem, especially considering the fact that it was because of politics. I think the NFL and its players made what should not be a political issue at all into one. The national anthem is, and by extension the flag, is a sign of respect not for any politician, political party, or set of partisan ideas, but a matter of respect, in my opinion, for the United States of America, the greatest country in the world, and the brave men and women, excuse me, who have fought and died to make this country great and to give us the freedom that we enjoy today and ensure our right to do things such as protest. At the very least, I hope they do their part to depoliticize the league and, frankly, be less selective about the types of free speech that they choose to uphold, especially when you consider the fact that as recently as this past season, they were initially not going to allow players to wear commemorative 9/11 cleats. It's very clear what this is. This is politicized. It's very unfortunate, and I hope they don't continue down that path, because I love the NFL, I love the Colts, I love football, and I don't want to see such a wonderful thing become politicized and fade away.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Michael Glab.
Voices in the Street was produced by Barbara Von Parvosky. Our engineer today is Chris Martin. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, this is Ron Bronson.
And I'm Carolyn Vanderweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered independent daily news program.
If you use iTunes or any other podcast app, you can have the show delivered to you directly. Just search for WFHB Daily Local News in your podcast tool of choice and subscribe to our podcast.
And stay tuned for Blooming Out, Indiana's only LGBTQI public affairs show, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.